take two on part six. We're running with a two-parter. If you didn't listen to it, I can't emphasize enough how much you have to go back and check out the Channing Frye podcast that we posted from earlier this week. Our typical Wednesday post is usually running through a litany of Suns topics. Channing Frye was able to give us some time, so we basically just dedicated the whole show to him. It was supposed to be like a 10-minute interview, Jim. That's what we originally planned, and then ended up just running with it, and the guy was just too personable and is such a good interview that we just let him take up the entire time spot. But here we are, episode 6.5. We're giving you a second dose so we can cover all the news and rumblings and everything that's been going on. Chris Habas, Bright Side of the Sun. Jim Kokenauer is on the line as well, Bright Side of the Sun as well. How are we doing today, Jim?
I'm doing good. That was great with Channing. I think, though, that he had an ulterior motive, and he's trying to just look a little bit too nice there. And what he was really doing was trying to stay away from the sick kids and everything for a little bit by hanging out with us on the phone.
Yeah, that's what he was doing. Exactly. I had bumped into him at practice the day before, and he was just talking about how everyone was sick, and he's not necessarily a cook, and he threw the same thing out on Twitter. He's like, I'm not a cook. I don't know what to do. Like, I need to find somewhere where I can buy food to get these people healthy, because I guess his wife and his kids were all sick, so he was the only one sitting there healthy, and I guess in a sense of a term, but he was the only healthy one in the house kind of taking care of everybody. But it was pretty cool. We got to see Channing as a golf analyst, a college hoops analyst, a Suns analyst, a dad for a minute, and I think all around it was really good stuff, and it was kind of a take a step away from all of the other radio interviews that had been going on with the Suns, where it was people venting their frustrations and going out there with their agendas. Everyone can genuinely say that Channing didn't have any kind of ulterior motive or agenda. He was just on here talking with us.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought he was very genuine with us when we did the interview, and like you said, it wasn't quite as salacious as some of the other stuff going on with the media feeding frenzy, but I think it gave everybody a chance to get in touch with one of the Suns players who's actually pretty well spoken and is good at, you know, conveying his thoughts and feelings in that type of form.
And I'm going to go ahead and step out of the closet here for a second, because you said in terms of, you know, feeding him more and, you know, with the whole stuff that's going on, I'm to a lesser degree, I'm a huge hoops head, but I also, unfortunately, am a huge wrestling fan. And wrestling is actually coming to town. That's why the Suns are going out of town. It's coming in. And you said, feed me more, which is the catchphrase of one of the guys out there, the men in tights. So you mentioned the feed me more. We're gonna feed a little bit more into that. And we're going to go into a little bit of kind of reviewing Lindsey Hunter's first 10 games, or first two games, rather. And 10 games is going to be quite a while, and we'll probably have a different take when we get to that point. But two games in, 2-0, a win on the road, a win at home. Both of them were very impressive in the fact that it was on a back-to-back. So they went in Wednesday and took care of business against the Kings, that are pretty much on par with them this season record-wise, and then came into town right away immediately after, took on the Clippers, national TV, TNT, Charles Barkley in the or in the TNT booth. You got Lenny Wilkins doing a symposium for Martin Luther King Day. All the glitz and the glamour in the world around there on national TV, keeping us in the arena till midnight, and they pull out a win in that one too. So, you know, two wins so far for Lindsey Hunter and his regime. And this is definitely a group effort, because as we talked about before we jumped on, we've been noticing a lot of interaction with the coaches, you know, the assistant coaches helping out, the assistant coaches calling plays, kind of pointing things out. Lindsey Hunter he's been very transparent with that. He's going to lean on the expertise of his guys. And what kind of expertise would he have to lean on if he had Elston Turner and Dan Majerle on his bench as well? But that's a different topic. But he's leaning on these guys and allowing them to help him become a better coach. And 2-0, I mean, you can't really argue with that. I mean, the first game is a coach killer game. And the second game was the fact that, you know, Chris Paul didn't suit it up and lace him up for the Clippers. So that game was pretty ugly if you got a chance to watch it, actually. I mean, the first 10 to 15 minutes was just bad basketball with turnovers galore. But they gutted it out. They grinded it out. They played good defense. I think the one thing I've noticed under Lindsey Hunter, and I'll pass this over to you on this, the one thing I've noticed under Lindsey Hunter is the first quarter and the fourth quarter play have been different in a good way than what they were at least under Alvin Gentry. And I'm not saying it was better, but it's been different in a good way in the respect that they're scoring a little more early in the first, and they're playing a little bit different in the fourth quarter in terms of how they're running their offense and Goran being more aggressive. I love seeing Goran being really aggressive in the first and the fourth quarter, because we mentioned before, I want him shooting 20 shots a game. He makes the money. He's the face of the franchise in that respect, and I like that he's being more aggressive.
Yeah, you can see a little bit of a change. I don't think that they can necessarily implement like a completely different philosophy from what they had over the course of a couple of practices with the new coach. Hunter definitely seems a little bit in over his heels. He doesn't have the coaching experience, obviously. He has zero that, you know, you'd expect for a more savvy, veteran, experienced head coach to kind of come in with that gravitas and a little bit of authority and take charge. So, like you had mentioned, he's been getting help from different assistants on the staff. And, you know, not that there's anything wrong with that at all, but he is definitely, he's the tyro. He's the novice at this, and he's learning on the fly. The team has responded. They've been playing well. They've been playing with heart. The first game, the defense still wasn't quite there. What they were doing is playing harassing defense. They forced a lot of turnovers that game, and that helped them overcome a huge rebounding disadvantage. And the Kings missed some free throws, which helped them. The Clippers also missed some free throws the next night, but. You know, they won on the road. That was the first game after the changeover. And for a team that was going into that 3-17 on the road, any win on the road against anybody is a good thing. And, you know, the second game, that one, the defense did actually look a little bit better. They, you know, were playing against a team without Chris Paul. So the Clippers are coming into that game kind of wounded. And the Suns, you know, did a good job of not embarrassing themselves, like you said, on the big stage. I don't know that I necessarily saw a whole lot of systematic changes. There was a little bit of a difference in the rotations. Beasley was given a little bit more liberty out there. It worked well in the first game, not quite so much in the second. Yeah, I mean, Beasley, you could say in the first game was the reason they won. I mean, he scored, I think, 13 points in that fourth quarter and carried the team through the run that pushed him over the top. So there's been a little bit of a difference in some of the rotations, but I think a lot of it's just a little bit more pep in their step with the whole dead coach bounce type of situation, and so we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, and to go back to the original point that I had made, they're scoring about 1.5 points more. Two-game sample size versus 41, by the way, so take this with a large, heavy dose of iodized salt. But they're scoring about 1.5 more points a game in the first quarter, 26 a night versus the 24.5 they were doing. And the big one is the 28.5 that they've scored on average in the fourth quarter. I think that's huge because they were falling all over themselves in the fourth quarter. They were scoring less points in the fourth than any other quarter. They were getting about 21.5, and that's where teams were able to basically, when you go into the game and the Suns had made their furious comeback in the second or the third quarter and they were wore out and then they just gave you nothing in the fourth, it's been a little bit different. And partially, you mentioned Beasley in the first game and then Goran in the second, which is really nice to see those two guys. And, you know, if you've watched any Michael Beasley basketball through his career and through this season, it's easy to judge him by looking at a box score and, you know, watching a post-game interview or, you know, saying that he looks up in the air and sees butterflies fluttering around his head. It's easy to judge him on that regard. But if you watch the games, the guy, when he makes his step to the basket and he shoots that little one-armed or two-handed floater about 7 to 8 feet away, that shot, if he can just knock that down like Tony Parker knocks down a teardrop, he's scoring 20 points a night consistently. It's a shot that hasn't been falling for him consistently this season, and he got it to go down against the Kings. It was hit or miss against the Clippers. If he can lock that down with what guys like Gortat already do and what guys like Scola, what they already do, Dudley and Brown, that adds a new wrinkle to the offense, and it makes it to where they can consistently get 24, 25 points per quarter versus getting somewhere between 18 and 22, which is where they were at, getting about 96 points a game on the season before the coaching change up. And, you know, now they're averaging just a touch more on offense, but a two-game sample size is obviously, you got to take that with a huge, huge dose of salt, and they're going to be going forward. We'll look at this next week with their upcoming schedule. But, I mean, overall with Lindsey Hunter, I'll let you go first on this one here, but overall first impressions, I know that you're watching from home and you can only see, like you had mentioned before to me, you only see what the camera shows you, but what are your overall impressions with the differences you've seen on the court, his coaching style, and just overall, what is your take on him so far with what he's done?
Yeah, I don't see anything that he's done wrong. Like I said, the biggest thing that I think has been the difference is that basically the Suns have made shots in the fourth quarters of the last couple games, Beasley in the first one, and then you had Brown and Scola hit a couple big shots and they executed. And I don't think that, oh, Lindsey Hunter's here now and now he taught him how to execute. Some of that is going to be the players that he puts on the floor, and so you can give him some of the credit there. But Gentry had a lot of guys out there doing a lot of different things, and they just couldn't execute. And I don't think you could have blamed that on him. In terms of his demeanor, he seemed kind of engaged in the game. He is active in the flow. He doesn't look like he's to the point where, like I said, he's kind of the veteran, hands-on guy that is, taking charge of the situation on the bench and, holding the clipboard and being the only one talking during the timeouts, and everybody, huddles around him. So he's still learning. Like I said, he's a Tyro. This is all new to him. So he's never been in this type of situation. It's going to be hard to gauge really how he's doing this early into it. So I don't really have like any way that I'd grade him yet. Just to say that obviously I don't think he's done anything that makes me say, oh my God, that we're doomed. So it's been, I guess he gets like an incomplete so far, maybe a C, a B, somewhere around there. I haven't seen anything too bad.
Yeah, and in terms of grading him, you're right. That's too tough to do on two games. I mean, if you're going to grade someone on two games, then he's amazing, and if you're going to grade, Alvin Gentry on 41 games, then he was terrible because he was 13-28. But, when you look at it, the things that I've seen that are different that I kind of like are he's the motion offense where they run the curls. He's been running that more in the mid-range versus running it out at the three-point line. So instead of guys like, Jared Dudley or Shannon Brown catching all the time on the elbow three, 25 or 22 to 25 feet away from the basket, they're catching it somewhere in that 16 to 18, 18 to 20 foot range where they can start to attack, little wrinkles to the offense, Beasley catching it after swinging it around from the other side and being able to attack and get that floater up, which, as we talked about, has been a hit or miss. Those are the little wrinkles to the offense that I've seen that I've liked. For the most part, it's all the same stuff, though. I mean, running a lot of the same offense, running a lot of pick and roll, kind of relying on the guys' strengths and letting them go out there and do what they do best, which is what Gentry did, too. He let the guys go out there and do what they did best. But anytime you bring in a new coach, you're going to get energized. So in terms of the defensive energy and the guys being excited and doing what they're doing, I think that the same energy would have been there whether the results were the same with Turner or Marley. And I don't think anyone would argue with that. I mean, I've called it the coach killer game a million times. I mean, look at the Bucks, the Nets, the Suns, any other team that has let go their coach midseason, the Lakers, even with Bernie Bickerstaff and the Lakers, was winning games. So anytime you let a coach go and you go with a new direction, it re-energizes the group for a small period of time. Now it's just, we'll see if that's sustainable. And I think that's really important. One thing that Lindsey did, and I don't know if this is his choice or if this is what he was supposed to do, but, in Alvin Gentry, or rather in the coach's office, Coach Gentry had his desk. He had a, long table for the rest of his assistants to sit at, and then they would kind of, break down the game plan and they would go over stuff, got all the TVs in there to watch the game. Well, instead of sitting at Alvin Gentry's desk kind of presumptuous as an interim coach, he actually just went and sat at the long coach's table and conducted a lot of his interview stuff and all of his media availability from that table, kind of showing that level of humility and just being humble, not assuming that this is his job, as much as a lot of the media backlash has been on Hunter of he was the coach in waiting and everyone knew this was going to happen. I'll give him this, and I've told you this from my interactions with him at practice and stuff. He's been holding himself fairly presidential. He's been holding himself to a nice degree. I like the way he's been carrying himself. He's been speaking very well to the media. He's not been getting slipped up by guys attacking him on the radio. And he's been doing a good job, in my opinion, of carrying himself as a head coach. And on the sideline, he's been leaning on his assistants, but who wouldn't in that situation? He's green. He's about as green as any NBA coach in the history of the league has been in their first two games.
Yeah, that's good to hear. I haven't been engaged with him in any kind of one-on-one or up-close personal manner. So, a rookie guy, you're going to probably see a lot of growth from him really quick. You're going to see what kind of person he's going to develop into as the rest of the season progresses, because I'd be surprised if, within even a couple weeks here, whether you're not going to be noticing Caprice in terms of the way he's handling things, just even in terms of taking more control of what he's doing with the practices and how he's acting in the timeouts and that type of stuff. One thing that I did notice in the last couple games too, and I don't know whether it has to do with any systematic changes that they have kind of made, is that the last couple games I was pretty impressed with the way the Suns played in the post and on the block. Cousins had 15 points and 15 points and 15 rebounds. And as hard as it is to kind of say, wow, you really shut a guy down and frustrated him when he goes for 15 and 15, I thought they did a really good job in there against him with Gortat and then with the switching and doubling and coming down. And same thing, I mean, the Clippers didn't really put anything inside. Some of that, maybe Chris Paul not being able to get the ball to those guys in the positions where they like it. But I thought that the Suns have really controlled the paint the last couple of games, and I don't remember a time when I can remember thinking that two consecutive games earlier in the season.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I'll disagree with you on that a little bit, we're very on the same page in terms of the fact that we agree with each other a lot when we're on here, which is why this works so well. But the one thing that I don't like about the defense, so you look at the defense and you go, they've given up, less than 100 points two games in a row. They did a good job, holding the Clippers to 88, sans Chris Paul. They did a good job of, holding the Kings to 96, and a lot of that is garbage points at the end. I would imagine they're holding them pretty well early on, but the one thing that they haven't done a good job with is closing out defensive possessions, and this has been a reoccurring theme all season, but they'll play really well defensively and then give up 18 offensive rebounds to the Sacramento Kings and give up 14 offensive rebounds to the Clippers. And both games were fairly tight in the rebounding margin. I mean, the Clipper game, they had lost it by a couple. And in the Kings game, they actually got dominated, almost lost it by 20. So the rebounding, I think, is something that they need to look at. Going specifically to the Clipper game that we were watching live, I mean, Marcin Gortat looked like he had no idea how to rebound a ball. It looked like a kid that was just went through his growth spurt and was used to playing on the perimeter and then was down on the block and he was being asked to rebound. And Blake Griffin was jumping over him, around him, everywhere, every which way. Eric Bledsoe was out rebounding him here and there with just effort, jumping over the 7-footer and taking the ball away from him. So the rebounding, I think, is going to be a huge problem with them going forward, because when you start facing teams like the Lakers and the Thunder and they start noticing those things, they're going to send in that extra runner on 3-point shots and they're going to murder you on the offensive glass and they're going to end up taking advantage of that. So those are the coaching things that Hunter's going to have to watch out for, is all these other veteran coaches are going to start to, they're going to watch film. They're going to see the weaknesses and they're going to attack the living heck out of it. And his job is to react. That's all coaching is reacting and having a plan and a game plan, being proactive and reactive, a nice balance of that to make sure that your team has a competitive advantage.
Right. Yeah. And you're going with the philosophy there, the idea, and most people would agree with that, that the defensive possession doesn't stop until you've secured the rebound. And what I was talking more to was the defense, up to the shot where they were frustrating a guy like Cousins into 6 turnovers and getting into under his skin to where he was discomposed, discombobulated and frustrated, angry. Almost got himself ejected from the game for starting to flip the ball around and throw it to the referees with a little bit more force than he probably should have been. And same type of thing, just causing some general commotion under there and keeping the other team from, getting the easy looks that they want. And then the end of it is, like you said, they have to secure the rebound, because what the Suns are doing is they're frustrating these guys into taking bad shots, taking contested shots. They're missing them, and which is giving them more opportunities to get more offensive rebounds. So, yeah, you got to play the complete possession. So I absolutely agree with that the defense needs to finish with the rebound. So they're playing good up to that penultimate point, and then that ultimate point of the possession is them giving the other team another opportunity. And so, yeah, they got to work on that.
Yeah, and to a finer point, I guess, and I completely understand what you're saying there too. So to a finer point, it's like, DeMarcus Cousins' double-double was as impressive as Drew Holiday's triple-double against the Suns, and the fact that he had numbers on a box score, but if you watch the game, you can clearly tell that they were frustrating him. They took him out of the game, and that's part of the reason why they won, is because they took out the most important player to the team like they did with Drew Holiday. Drew Holiday had a triple-double, applauds from everybody, but if you watch that game, you go, how did he have a triple-double? Because they frustrated the living heck out of him. He got all his points and all his assists and rebounds basically in the first quarter, and with Cousins, it was the same thing. He went out there, dominated the glass in that respect, but then again, the Kings as a team dominated the glass, and the Suns were still able to win that game pretty handily. I mean, they were in control of that game for the most part from the jump in that game. So, you know, I get where you're coming from. I completely understand that, and the fact that they were frustrating. I mean, they're playing more tough defense in the paint. I guess that's more of where you're going with that, is that they're finishing possessions and playing defensive possessions all the way up to that rebound. And my thing is, they got to get that rebound now.
Yep, absolutely. You got to finish the possession. So now that we got Hunter in here, he's going to teach these guys how to finish possessions. And so, you know, we should be good to go. We got two wins. We're 2-0 in the Hunter era, the Lindsey Hunter era. We've now entered for Phoenix Suns basketball. We had the 7 seconds or less era. We had the Nash era. That's all gone behind us. And so now we don't have to we can keep that in the rearview mirror. That's just a distant fading memory. And we've got the Lindsey Hunter era to look forward to. All the auspicious tidings that brings, you know, they're 2-0. And so I think we're going to string off a bunch of wins here. The Suns should be back in the playoff hunt, and the world is back right side up, and things are looking sunny, butterflies and bumblebees, right?
Now, the interesting thing about that, as I'm going to not read into that or feed into your little trap there, but so we were talking before, and I want to transition away from Lindsey Hunter for a minute, because that has been the overall writing theme since last week on Thursday. It's been almost nonstop 9 days consecutive of Lindsey Hunter, as this is going to go up on Saturday with you guys listening to it. It's been 9 days of Lindsey Hunter. Even before he was the head coach, Adrian Wojnarowski of Yahoo, John Gambadoro of 620, Paul Coro of the Arizona Republic, myself in my head, everybody was saying, yeah, this is Lindsey Hunter. He's getting it. They're going to interview everybody, but he's getting it. So this has been ad nauseum Lindsey Hunter. And, you know, we gave him the first half of the podcast. Now, I want to switch gears. Me and you were talking about something very interesting. And to go back to your era's comment, remember, you know, at the very beginning of the season, the Suns gave access to all of us. We're over there talking to the players, getting to know everybody. Lon Babby describes this as a new era of Phoenix Suns basketball. Do we now have a refreshed new era in the new – it's like paradox in a box there. As we go from a new era 41 games ago – you know, training camp plus 41 games. Now we have another new era of Phoenix Suns basketball as we got a new head coach. I mean, you can't have the same era with a different leader. I mean, it's a different thing now. So they go into a new era with a new coach. And we talked about the philosophy of how to rebuild a team off of the podcast before. And I want to kind of revisit that conversation here for a little bit. There's two different ways you can rebuild a team and go from being good to rebuilding, from being mediocre like the Suns were the past couple of years to rebuilding. And one way to do that is to, you know, whisper in Goran Dragic's ear and go, hey, in the fourth quarter, if the game's tight, I want you to shoot some off-balance threes and make sure you get the ball to Gortat, and he's going to shoot some fadeaways 4 feet outside of his comfort zone. That's not how you, that's, you know, that's losing on purpose. That's tanking. And in the NBA game, you don't tank. As much as people think teams tank, they don't. They just rebuild in a way that they remove the players that win them games right now and bring in players that win you games later through development for a couple of years that are going to be rough and are going to be tough to watch for fans. But if you look at the Oklahoma City Thunder, they went through a few rough years that were tough to watch as fans, and now they're on the pinnacle and they're ready to go to maybe another NBA Finals back-to-back years with the way they're playing. So I kind of want to get your take on that, in the fact that the Suns have basically straddled the line of mediocrity for 3 years instead of finding that way to kind of reset the roster and go in a direction toward their rebuilding, but rebuilding the right way without tanking.
Yeah. The Suns, for a couple of years now, they've been enveloped in this stasis of mediocrity. They're stuck right in this middle ground, which is the purgatory of the NBA. And I think that, you know, this year they've actually started to extricate themselves from that quagmire. Over the last couple of years, I mean, just, you know, 2009-10 to now, they've gone from the penthouse to the outhouse. That the team, you know, has already, we get kind of teased with a reboot thing. The team has actually gone through like a cataclysmic reboot, in my estimation, from that point. And the part of the reboot that is still in question is whether this is pretty much the reboot and we're at the end of the reboot, and that the reboot started at the point that Lon Babby was hired and Amari Stoudemire left, and that team went away, and then the beginning point of the reboot is Babby blanks, then the choices they made, Nash leaving, Gentry leaving, Marley leaving, everybody, and now the reboot is basically complete. We've rebooted. The team is horrible, and now we've got nowhere to go but up. We've got almost no ties to any of the old legendary type of sons, these people that are going to be entrenched in the team's history. These fan favorites like Nash and Stoudemire and Marley are gone. We've gotten rid of basically anything that's, you know, deemed in terms of respectability for the coaches. And like I've mentioned before, so from the owner to the front office to the coach to the players, there's almost nothing of real value in this franchise that other teams are trying to emulate, that other teams are like, yeah, we got to be like the Suns. You know, we need to have player development like the Suns. We need to draft like the Suns. We need a coach like the Suns. We need to kill it in the front office like the Suns, have a great GM that makes great trades and is well respected around the league, have an owner like the Suns. So we don't have any of those things. So you know, have they tanked on purpose? You know, I've heard the thing that's come up, stealth tanking. Where does this kind of fall into line? Because in terms of, you know, have they accidentally become this bad? Because they said they didn't want to be this bad, and they said, you know, we don't want to take these steps backward. But is that actually another one of the, you know, these areas of dubiety where, you know, they maybe have this side plan, this unknown game plan that they have, that they're, you know, an undercurrent to this? Because, you know, obviously the strategy that you got to win against all costs right now, you know, you got to mortgage the future to try to get the 13th pick instead of being a little bit worse is completely specious. That'd be like, you know, me saying, oh, my life, my quality of life now is going to be better if I spend all my money now so I can have more fun short term, instead of I should save money to put myself through school so I can get a better job and have all these things and have a much better life in the long term. You know, so, I mean, trying to win a few games now, meaningless games, I mean, either be good or be bad. And if you can't be good, then be bad so that you can get good.
Yeah, and one thing that you mentioned there is that there's not anything that the Suns are doing right now that other teams want to emulate. When you look back 8 years ago and Mike D'Antoni and Steve Nash and the small lineup and the run and gun and all that stuff, was everything that the Suns did threatened the rest of the league to an extent. I'm not going to say everybody was shaking their boots going, we need a change, but obviously to a certain degree, everything that they did made it to the point where either a team was saying, we need to emulate this to compete, or we need to come up with the remedy to this to be able to beat them. And teams like the Spurs were adding more depth to their team, and they were adding more scoring to their team, situational scoring, so that way when they get to the playoffs and the Suns get into that run and gun, well, it's like, hey, if you're knocking our defense around a little bit, well, guess what? We got some guys we can plug in that can shoot, and now we're going to beat you in the playoffs. Or the Lakers, they go out there and they get some bigs, and they go out there and they are able to beat the Suns in the playoffs. Like you mentioned, the last time they were in the penthouse, 2010 Western Conference Finals, a Ron Artest Tippett away from pushing this to a 6th, 7th game and maybe sneaking into the finals, which would have been, I don't know, I'm not going to say it would have been one of the worst teams in the history of the NBA Finals, but it would have definitely been one of the most unlikely teams to ever get there. And now, over the past couple of years, unfortunate regression, borderline 500 teams, the purgatory of the NBA. So there's different ways that you go about becoming a team that gets in a position to collect assets, and then you get good over time and you become a Spurs, you become a Thunder, you become a team like that that you can look at and you can go, wow, we're going to be good for quite a while. You know, one guy leaving or one guy getting hurt is not going to cataclysmically destroy our season or a couple of seasons for us. So you go about that by not picking up a guy like Lewis Scola on amnesty waivers. Love the guy, like what he can do for the team, but he adds a couple extra wins. You don't go out there and draft Kendall Marshall and then sign Goran Dragic. All that does is add a couple of more wins. You know, you go out there and you take advantage of a Steve Nash trade when it's presented to you 2 years ago, not during the offseason when he's going to walk anyway. You know, same thing with Grant Hill. These are the kind of things where that's not tanking on purpose. That's not whispering in someone's ear and saying, go out there and miss shots in the fourth quarter. We're going to now be the White Sox or the, you know, back in the 1900s, you know, the Black Sox. We're going to go out there and we're going to try and win games with our young guys and develop them. And they just didn't do that. They've fallen into that purgatory, and they've gotten kind of comfortable with it. And it's really hard to get out of that in the NBA. It's really hard to get out of that purgatory. You know, Utah and Phoenix have been in it for quite a while. Only 15 seasons the Suns have ever missed the playoffs in their 45-year franchise history. They're consistently good, and on some levels, or some years, they're elite and very good. But, you know, this is new for everybody, losing and not being a good team. So when you see them go out there and they now win two in a row and they bump their draft stock odds, you know, up a little bit in the wrong way, and now they're higher up in the lottery than they would have been. So these are the kind of things where you go, well, what are you doing? You know, you say you want to develop and you want to, you know, hit the reset button, but you're out there, you know, winning games and you're out there changing things up in that regard. I'm not saying you want to lose games, but the only way you can get better sometimes is to take a step back and kind of reset things. They did that with Hunter and the coaching staff. It just doesn't feel like they do that with the roster very often, and the roster is going out there and they're the ones that are going to be able to win these games. So I believe in building through the draft. These guys feel that you can build through the draft and free agency, but all that's done is made them a remarkably 500 team for the past 3 years, excluding this year.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the thing. Now they've gotten bad, and they've made these moves that are counterintuitive and contradictory, like you said, because if you're going to try to compete, then Luis Scola is a great signing at that price. I mean, that's a solid pickup if you're a team that's going to try to compete. But if you're going to be bad, then that's a horrible pickup. And you have to know who you are. You mentioned the Spurs right there. And, you know, that's this team that the Suns have detested, their fans at least, you know, that this team has just, you know, constantly, you know, beaten the Suns in every meaningful game they've played over the last decade and thwarted the Suns' championship aspirations. But, you know, that organization has everything that the Suns should be trying to emulate and that they've failed to do right now. And another thing that I don't like about the way that this has trended for the Suns, and, you know, like we said, I mean, the Suns, there's no way that somebody should be saying, okay, yeah, we're going to try to lose this on purpose. You know, we're going to come down to the last 10 games of the season, and Goran Dragic is suddenly going to have some undisclosed illness, and Marcin Gortat is going to be benched, and, you know, we're going to play Wesley Johnson 48 minutes. So, you know, not like throwing games on purpose, but, you know, putting yourself, you know, in the position where you need to be to get the best advantage moving forward and looking forward into the future, not just at the short term. And if the Suns were going to be bad this year, they could have went about it a lot better. So not only is the team bad, but it's embarrassing in a way, the way they've gone about handling this, because they could have been bad this year and not had this PR nightmare and turned it into the disaster that they have.
Yeah.
And that goes to back where I was talking about the reboot. And so is the reboot complete, or is the reboot complete this offseason when Babby and Blanks leave? Because that's the last thing that, you know, you have some hope for, because sometimes people, I think, treat Sarver as this bête noir, that he's this, you know, pernicious, pervasive, malicious force that is hell-bent on the destruction of our team and its legacy and all this. But I don't think that. I just think that he's made some bad decisions in terms of who he's hiring to run the team. From Channing Frye, Alvin Gentry, a lot of people who had no reason that they needed to have went to bat for this guy in terms of the fact that he does care about the team, he wants to win. So I have no reason to believe anything other than that. But, you know, the demolition phase that we've seen this year and their inability to orchestrate and, implement their own plan, because the plan that they said was to not be like this, and they've not only become like this, but looked very bad in doing so.
Yeah, and two things with that is, one, I do genuinely believe that they were genuine in thinking that this team could be better than last year. And last year they were 500 even, you know, 33-33. I do think that they genuinely thought that this team, the way they were put together, and me and you talked about this in the preseason, hey, if Goran goes out there and, you know, puts up like 18-7 or 16-8, something like that. You know, Scola goes out there and scores 18, and, you know, maybe Beasley gives them 16 off of the bench. You know, maybe Dudley gives them 16. You say all those things, and you look at their score charts, and they have no guys scoring more than 14 points a game, and that's Goran Dragic. So all the things that had to go right, and this is the same for every single team. All the things that had to go right, unfortunately, didn't go right this year. Goran's had a very good year, but he hasn't had the year that would elevate them to be better than last year. Scola the same thing, Gortat the same. All the guys across the board just did, all the stuff didn't click and it didn't work in year one. You know, same thing's happening with the Lakers. You know, everyone's talking about the Lakers. I felt like we had to say their name once. So in terms of that, I disagree a little bit because I think they genuinely thought that they can win. Now, are you right in the fact that maybe they need new leadership? Maybe. Maybe they do. I think Lon Babbie can do this job, and I think that he's, you know, he's a former agent, his first year doing it. So I think he can do the job, but it's his first year doing it, growing pains, you know, kind of like Lindsey Hunter is right now. He's first year, and he's going to eventually go through those growing pains. Maybe he should have, you know, taken a smaller role with the team and then built himself up. That might have been the right route to go. You know, the general manager, we all have our takes on that, and I'm pretty out there. I've said it before. When you're thing is the draft and you're great at being drafting players, like Robert Sarver said that Lance Blanks is, you look at his track record and he was part of franchises that drafted Christian Ayanga, Daniel Booby Gibson, Shannon Brown, Kendall Marshall, Markieff Morris. None of those guys were all-stars. Granted, none of them were number one overall picks, but none of those guys are tremendous, amazing, great franchise-changing players. None of them were steals in the spots that they got them. Some of them were actually overshot by the spot they were taken by a lot, if you look back in hindsight. So he's clearly not this amazing draft guru, or else we would have all these gems across the bench to start to go, hey, let's put them in the game. Let's let them develop and get more gems in the draft. So that's the one thing, is that I think that these guys, I think Babbie can do the job. I think Blanks is probably a little bit out of his league. And I think that they do need to hire more basketball guys. I think Sarver does need to hire some more basketball guys. And the second thing is, he gets painted as this malicious guy, and then everyone else paints him as this naive guy being taken advantage by the malicious duo of Babbie and Blanks. And I think both of those are wrong. I don't think Sarver is maliciously trying to lose games. His money is invested in this team. And I don't think Babbie and Blanks came in going, wow, look at this naive guy. We're going to take advantage of him and create this terrible team and play Monopoly with him and just make a bunch of money and just have some fun with a board game. Neither of those two things are happening. It's just, it's the imperfect storm where the players didn't click, the expectations weren't met, and a lot of bad decisions are being highlighted by a losing year, and everything's going to have to be reevaluated this summer. I'm not sitting here saying Babbie should be safe. All these guys need to be reevaluated. Hunter, Sarver needs to evaluate himself and look in the mirror. Babbie and Blanks need to be evaluated. The scouting team, player development, everything needs to be evaluated this summer. And if you're going to hit the reset button, unfortunately, that means flushing everybody out and then bringing in a new group to run the team. And if that's what they need to do, then I'm all for it. If that's not what they need to do, they need to look around and make the little tweaks that need to happen. But being in basketball purgatory is not fun. And you look at the San Antonio Spurs, you know, look, we're recording this Friday night to go up on Saturday. They're shorthanded, minus their head coach and minus Tim Duncan, and they're winning a game against the Dallas Mavericks on the road, and then they're going to fly home and the Suns get to play them tomorrow, and then the Suns ironically play the Dallas Mavericks on Sunday. Let's take a sneak peek into those games. So tonight against San Antonio, let's pretend they're Duncan and Popovich-less, because there's really no point in those guys coming out there for a Suns game. What do you see with that game, and then leading into a back-to-back against Dallas on the road on Sunday?
Yeah, the Spurs, that's just too much of a solid overall team. They've obviously had their problems in the postseason the recent years. They just haven't been able to get over the top despite playing great in the regular season, so they've had their issues there. But if you look at the Spurs team, that's not really a team that's going to be completely decimated by the loss of any one player. I would say that probably the most valuable player on the team, in my estimation, is Tony Parker. Duncan has been having a great year. He got named as reserve to the All-Star game, and I would say you could make a really strong case that actually he's the best big in the West. I think he's averaging like 18 points and 11 rebounds, something like that. I mean, he's been having a really good year after he had kind of tapered off a little bit. And I haven't looked into it, but I'm sure his per 36 numbers are probably outstanding because he's probably not putting in the burn that he did, you know, 5-10 years ago. So coming up with those numbers, it's probably in a little bit of lighter duty. So the team is solid overall, though. I was looking at some of the stuff because I got to preview that game tomorrow. That they're actually number one in the NBA in assists. They share the ball so well that, and they're still one of the better defensive teams in the league. But then now they score so many points, so they just have everything working for them. They have so many things going in their favor that even if you do take out a big piece, like Duncan for a period, that I still don't see how they're going to have a problem handling the Suns. And with the mix of veterans and everybody, and the way Popovich does instill his philosophy on that team, he's a really good coach. Those guys all know their roles and know what to do. So they shouldn't have a problem executing the game plan in his absence for a short spell.
Yeah, and you know what? It's kind of, to look at that game, it's almost like the perfect storm for Lindsey Hunter to start as a coach. So in hindsight, you go, wow, these guys are smart. They gave Lindsey Hunter a handful of days of practice. They then send him out against the Sacramento Kings, who are just as bad as the Suns were at that point, record-wise, in terms of on-the-court play. Then they get the Clippers on a back-to-back. Granted, it's a back-to-back, but it's without Chris Paul, so perfect. Another opportunity to win, and it's at home, national TV, Barkley, all this stuff kind of going in their favor, a lot of energy. And then they get a day off to practice, then they're going to head out to San Antonio. That's not good. Well, maybe they're going to be without Greg Popovich and Tim Duncan, and they're going to be playing on a back-to-back where they're flying in off of the road from playing Dallas. Then you go to Dallas, and that team is kind of very mirror image of the Suns, where they're just lacking in certain areas and they're having an underachieving season from what expectations were coming in. So it's a very perfect storm in regards to the imperfect storm I mentioned before, where it's foreseeable that they can go 4-0 under Lindsey Hunter to start the regime, and then you start looking at the schedule afterwards and go, holy cow. But it's very, very realistic to sit back and go, yeah, they could probably win these two games, but is that going to happen? I don't think so. Sorry to be Mr. Negativity on this one, but I do think that, taking your moniker, I do think they're going to drop both of these games in respect of San Antonio, everything you just said. I don't need to repeat it. They're deep, and they have the ability to weather storms. And then Dallas, they do throw out O.J. Mayo and Dirk Nowitzki, which is a little bit better than anything that the Suns are going to be able to throw out on the court. So in terms of that, they have guys that can close it out at the end. They have guys that can take care of business. And to real quick throw a football analogy out there, when you look at the three teams we just talked about, and this is my last take, and I'll throw it over to you to kind of wrap up the show today. When you look at the San Antonio Spurs, they're very similar to the New England Patriots. They got Tim Duncan. They got everything set up with their coach. They won a handful of championships in a short period of time. Then they maintain consistency, but just haven't been able to get over the hump because they lack that elite superstar guy that's new in the league that can carry them over the hump. I'm not saying Tom Brady's not a superstar, but it's just the teams have found out a way to beat them, and they don't have that extra oomph that they did when they were a little younger. Kind of the same thing with the San Antonio Spurs, and the Dallas Mavericks are very similar to the Indianapolis Colts, where they had a flashy, different style of playing. They had Peyton Manning, and they have Dirk Nowitzki. They get to a championship, win one, lose one. It's been hit or miss for them. They've been consistently good. And then you have the Suns, who are like the San Diego Chargers, who are just, they're always in the conversation, and they have their peaks and valleys, but they're never able to topple those guys because they just have the guys that are just on another level, Hall of Fame good. So throwing out a random football analogy, just as soon as we saw those three teams, that's what popped in my head. I've always thought the Spurs were very similar to the Patriots. And you look at the career trajectory of Dirk and Peyton Manning, of Tom Brady and Tim Duncan, and of like the San Diego Chargers and then the Phoenix Suns. It's kind of eerily similar in the fact that the Suns have always been the little brother to those two teams, and then Dallas has been the little brother to Dallas or to San Antonio, and San Antonio has been dominant but hasn't really seen the light of day in about 6 years because they haven't been able to get over the hump.
Yeah, with your analogy there, I can definitely see the comparison between the Patriots and the Spurs. That seems pretty good, and also the Colts and Mavs. I can kind of sign on with that, with the whole Peyton-Nowitzki parallel there. But I would say, if I had to go off of what you're doing, that I would say that the Suns were more like the St. Louis Rams minus the Super Bowl victory.
Yeah, and that's the only caveat, is the one Super Bowl victory. But that is probably the analogy I'd go with. If Warner and Co. lost that Super Bowl, then that would easily be like slam dunk home run for me.
Yeah, that would have been them. So, yeah, so you are thinking we're going to lose, but you also see the shred of a possibility that this could kind of get interesting with the Suns actually winning these next two, going 4-0 in the week. I think they're going to lose them both too. But what's interesting now is it gets back to the point, just like we kind of mentioned with tanking before and winning and losing and how all that plays into it. With the Suns are now separated from fourth place to 11th place in the lottery by just two victories. So right now the Suns have 15 wins. there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 teams that are within 2 wins of them right now. So, I mean, they could jump, you know, from possibly being, like, right near the bottom of that and having the great odds of landing a top 3, top 4 pick to being right back at the back end of the lottery at that place we dread. And it might just be a couple wins one way or the other that are the deciding factor in that. I mean, you could actually literally see the Suns by when we play the Lakers next week. We could be challenging to pass them on that night. So I'm actually conflicted as a fan of the Suns right now, because it's like, you know, I mean, when they win, it's like, yeah, I want them to win, but it's like almost like it's self-destructive at the same time. I mean, it's a really weird situation that we have looking forward, and the Suns can only make it more gut-wrenching and hard for us to feel, you know, see exactly where we feel on it if they do win a couple of games here, to where it's like, well, you know, are they on that border? I mean, if they just lose a bunch of games, it's really easy, because then we can be emotionally detached. The team's horrible. We're cheering for the number one pick. They actually start winning a some, and now it gets even harder for us to watch the team moving forward.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head in the win column. These two wins put them tied for the 13th spot in the win column in terms of the draft lottery. They'll be in the 13th spot, but the 28 losses separate them and drag them down. The other teams don't have that many losses just yet. But, yeah, it's interesting. It's going to get to the point you never root for your team to lose, but you also want to root for them to get better. So it's extremely conflicting. So tonight the Suns will tip off against the San Antonio Spurs, 6:30 tip. I'm challenging everyone in the get into the game thread and have that conversation when that goes up right around tip-off. But in the chat box here, I would strongly encourage everybody, winning, losing, tanking, trading, etc., why not get that conversation going? Let's start talking about that kind of stuff, and let's see from the Suns fans, the voice that Robert Sarver says thinks that, you know, the fans are very happy with what's going on. They're not disgruntled, according to him on that radio interview he had on 620. Let's challenge that. The Bright Side of the Sun is arguably the biggest voice of the Phoenix Suns from the fan community. So get in the chat box. Let's get that going, and let's see what that looks like.
Okay, I will lead it off. My first trade idea, I'd like some trades. I want to trade Lindsey Hunter for Kevin Durant. That's my suggestion.
And we'll trade Greg Popovich for Goran Dragic, and then we're all aces. All right, guys. Well, let's wrap it up. This was a great Part 2, 6.5 edition. We'll be back Tuesday with an extremely Laker-centric and hopefully not exceedingly negative podcast, talking about a back-to-back weekend that could be 2 losses and then a month of February that could be brutal. But for Chris Habas, Jim Kochenour, that's a wrap. We'll catch you guys next week on Tuesday. Enjoy the game this weekend.